from Lacrosse with 3 gin and tonics in me. It is time for Development Hell. It's episode number 11, Ed. Can you believe we made it to another prime number?
No, I cannot.
So on my wonderful wireless USB headset is Chris Harches, and on the other end, it's our other host, Ed Fingler. Say hi to the internet.
Howdy, everybody.
So we've made it to episode number 11, and before we get started, I want to, as always, thank our awesome sponsor, EngineYard. EngineYard, if you're looking for a platform as a service that supports both Ruby and PHP through our awesome friends at Orchestra.io, you should check them out. I'm sure Ed will make more fun of EngineYard and Orchestra in the middle of the podcast.
Yep.
But thanks very much. We're going to spend your money wisely. I'll probably spend most of it on more gin and tonics while I'm in Lacrosse.
Yep.
So this week, kids, we have a very special guest. It is a superhuman developer from Montreal who's now residing in Toronto, who we know as Joel, but everyone else might know as Joel Paris. Say hi to everybody.
Hey, everyone.
That's it? Hey, everyone. Man, this is going to be a really short podcast if you're going to be like that.
Well, the secret is I actually had mute. And I started a sentence, and then I forget I might as well restart it. Then lost my train of thought. So
the reason we have Joel on, the reason we have Joel on is because not only is he unfortunate enough to be our close personal friends, but he also happens to work with Ed, and he's a guy that I'm jealous of because he made one of the successful leaps from doing PHP stuff to doing Python, and I guess now he's slumming again doing PHP stuff for Fictive Kin. So why don't you tell us a little, tell our listeners, all three of them who are left after I talked about gin and tonics, who are listening, and tell everybody a bit about yourself.
Yeah.
Slumming it. So my name is Joel. I've been a developer for basically as long as people have been paying me money to do programming. That's probably going on about 10 years now. Started off doing a lot of stuff in random things. I think my first professional job was writing, I know exactly what it was. It was writing a JSP page. So this was in a time when Java Server pages were still really popular and awesome. Weren't a joke. And it was for a paper company. I kid you not, it was for a company that sold paper. And they had this huge catalog inventory. And their entire internal system was written in some homebrew Java internal application, and they wanted a way to be able to show their inventory on a website. I had basically been tasked to do this with my first job. This was the first place I worked part-time when I was still in high school, I believe. And actually, the way that it came about that I worked there was pretty hilarious. I could talk about that later. I basically got my first job at the gas station.
I'm sorry.
Not done. Let him go. Keep going, Joel.
I'll edit that in later.
I got my first job actually out of a gas station, and it was not sexually in any nature. So.
Oh, weird.
Then
that's so unexpected coming from you.
Yeah, that right.
I do hang around gas stations a lot. Then stayed with this company for a little while, really just like a small little dev shop based on the South Shore of Montreal. Moved to Montreal proper to go to university, did a bit of stuff there, started to work for another company called Plank, which is actually a really awesome company, and I still keep in touch with some people there. They do some awesome work. And then started hopping around at various different other places, consulting, development at different startups, small stage, mid stage. A little bit of odd jobs here and there, really just to try and round myself out as a developer and figure out what I wanted to do, which I think was pretty instrumental in trying to figure out what my skill sets are, what they aren't, and where I wanted to go. And then most recently, ended up at Fictive Kin, along with Ed, whom I get to talk to every day, which is a great pleasure.
No, it's not really.
No, I was going to say, I don't consider it much of a pleasure either, just a more like a necessary evil.
Yeah.
And I've been there for, what was it, since the beginning of last month. So almost coming up 2 months now.
Let's just say that, yes, it's been that way.
Now you guys are gonna dump him just before his 90-day probationary period's up, right?
Yeah, right.
Well, Sean has already fired me twice. So.
Yeah, right.
If I make it to 2 months, it'll be good.
Yeah, right.
Sean has an auto fire. If you mention CoffeeScript in his presence, you're just automatically canned.
I know, it's so sad. Jesus. So didn't you you were didn't necessarily start off thinking you were going to get into you know, programming necessarily, yeah? I mean, didn't you like have another plan for your life or something?
Well, yeah, I guess it's hard to describe. I didn't go to school in computer science per se. I did quite a few computer science classes later on in my degree when I realized that I enjoyed it quite a lot and I wanted to do that professionally more than just part-time to pay for school. But I studied physics and mathematics at McGill University. So I specialized in theoretical physics in that particular program. And did a bit of work in high energy particle physics, along with some other internships along the way. I did some stuff in biophysics, which was pretty interesting. And so a lot of really, I guess, like math-oriented things interested me. And kind of fell on programming almost accidentally. Coming back to the previous story, I wanted to teach myself how to program probably since I was about 11 or 12. And when I was 11 or 12, I went to the library, because people still did that then, mm-hmm. and got out a book on how to program. And of course, you know, as a kid, you're really interested in video games and whatnot. So, of course, I think my first book that I took out was on 3D game programming. And that was a complete and utter failure, especially when you start talking about, like, quad trees and whatnot. And this is someone who didn't even know how an object model worked or what a garbage collector was. So,
right. 3D still don't.
Real nice, right?
3D programming probably wasn't the best intro. So when I figured that out, I went back a little bit later and got a book on introductory programming in Java. And after maybe two or three false starts, figured out what was going on, because books at the time, and I think not so much these days, since it's a bit more there's a bit more knowledge on how to teach programming correctly. They kind of assume that you already knew how to program something else, and you're just jumping in and wanted to learn the new Java syntax since it was all hot at the time. So wrapping my mind around the object model and what, you know, this referred to and what a superclass was took quite some time. Finally managed to write some simple programs and teach myself some programming, and then wanted to get into some web stuff because that seemed to be a really interesting avenue, other than just making, you know, simple command line calculators that every little book made you do as an example. Didn't really do anything professionally for a while. And at one point, I ended up working at a gas station part-time on the weekends, basically to save up some money to pay my way through school. And while I was doing that, it was night shifts on the weekends. And one of my clients, they used to come by pretty much every Thursday night or Friday night to come get a pack of cigarettes. I'm guessing like after he finished working. He stopped by and he looked really, really down on the dumpster and not too happy. And I decided to try and cheer him up and see what was going on. And so I just poked around a bit, and it turns out that he was sad that they wanted this. He worked for the company, this development company. They wanted this contract. They weren't able to get it because they didn't have the talent to be able to program that particular language and this particular framework. And they needed the money, but they weren't sure how to do it. So they're trying to figure out a way out of it. And they had until Monday to figure it out. And I nonchalantly ask him, like, oh, what programming language is it in? And he kind of looks at me and he says, like, well, it's in Java server pages. I look at him and I say, well, oh, I can do that. And I just sold him a pack of cigarettes at this point. So he was a bit skeptical. Asked me a few questions.
I cannot imagine why.
Yeah, asked me a few questions. Told me to come in for an interview on Monday. I went in, passed the interview, and they hired me part-time on the spot. And that is actually how I got into professional programming.
So you sold a man a pack of cigarettes, and out of that became a burgeoning career.
Yep.
Nice.
Now,
that's way better than my backstory. That sucks. Keep going, Joel.
Well, I'm saying I'm pretty sure I would have ended up in programming at some point. It would have just taken a bit longer, and I might have taken a slightly different path, and I would have ended up in different places for sure. But it was a bit of a serendipitous moment, I guess, that all those things kind of just came together.
So before you ended up with the fine folks at Fictive, Ken, you, if I remember, you were working for our place in Toronto and you were doing machine learning. So one of the things I've written down on our awesome pirate pad here was that if you could talk to perhaps give like a little machine learning for noobs to kind of give us an idea of what machine learning is all about and trying to explain it in a way that even a dumb Canadian PHP programmer like me could understand it.
Huh. Sure. So the company I worked at was a startup based out of Toronto called Unata. And what they're building is a platform for doing machine learning and analytics on purchases and purchase histories for consumer goods. And it's all a business-to-business company. So the idea is you end up going to companies like, let's say, a grocer or a big box retailer, and telling them, like, look, you have all of these things. You have a loyalty program. You know what people are buying. You have receipt data. You have your whole item and product inventory that have, you know, descriptive fields to all the elements. You know the prices. You know all these things about your stuff that you're selling, but you're unable to do anything more than just offer coupons or specials based on the fact that last quarter around this time, you sold a lot of television sets because people want to buy television sets before X sporting event or whatnot. So there's all this data lying around that people could be using to better monetize and to better advertise to their consumer base. And why I was hired on there as the senior architect to help develop a system that was able to do this. My primary role there was to develop the distributed system to do the computations and to also help on the actual implementation and development of the algorithms being used. I obviously was alone in this. We actually had a fantastic guy who was our main computer scientist, who his name is Diego, a super awesome guy. We imported him from Argentina, did his master's degree at MIT, got a Fulbright scholarship as well, which is basically incredible, really, really intelligent guy. And with him and another guy named Amr, we built up this whole system to be able to do all this computationally intensive tasks to figure out what people should be, what people would be most interested in buying based on previous purchasing habits and a whole bunch of other contextual information that I may or may not be able to talk about.
Cool story, bro.
So essentially, you tried to you made a system that would figure out that I wanted to buy chocolate chip cookies after I bought a Hustler magazine or something like that. Right?
I don't think we ever had that in our cross validation, but yeah, that might have been a pretty good case.
Yeah, there you go.
I admire your taste, Ed. Hustler is really high class.
Yes, I stick to the classy stuff.
So there's a lot of things going on, and especially when you're talking about non-fake data, when you talk about real data, like a grocer or a retailer, their data sets are very rarely in an ideal and pristine condition. Oftentimes they've been mangled over the years. They've been gone through two or three different iterations of a different SAP product. Fields are missing, they're wrong, they're corrupt, they don't have the right values, units are in the wrong dimensions for certain products, or they're different across things. So a lot of the trouble is actually making sure you can normalize across those different inconsistencies, and then being able to try and make sense out of all that. So to come back to like Ed's example with a grocer, he's talking about like a chocolate bar in a Hustler magazine. That's actually something that could very much be possible to determine. There's a lot of different avenues. You can do like a co-purchase analysis, which is, let's say you walk into an Apple store and you buy an iPod. Well, you can also look at all the other people that bought iPods and find out what is the most common item that people purchase with that. Is it perhaps the AppleCare or a wall adapter or an extra set of headphones or maybe an iPod case? And then you can go and try and upsell that based on the fact that you know that 75% of people are going to try and buy this other item. So maybe you want to try and incentivize that. Maybe not necessarily give them a discount since you know that a lot of people are going to be buying it, but maybe try and sell a more expensive item or a house brand item that you have higher margins. There's a lot of these like little tricks that you can do. And when you go with a retailer that might have something like a loyalty program, you get a lot more information because then you suddenly have historical data that you can tie. So, for example, you can go in there and say, well, 2 weeks before Thanksgiving, it turns out that this particular family or this particular person tends to buy a lot of these items. Let's try and factor that into what we're doing, into the equation. And maybe we can figure out some periodization that makes this useful, that we can then be able to predict when they're going to be using similar items in the future that might not be, let's say, around Thanksgiving, might be later on in the year, maybe for Easter.
So, like right before Christmas, they'll buy, like, a bunch of alcohol. And then, like, the day after Christmas, they buy a gun.
Yeah, so, Joel, I mean, assuming, I'm guessing you're talking about the States, because I'm like, well, no place would sell alcohol and guns.
But of
I'm
course
like,
oh, not.
I'm pretty sure they're,
yeah, well, you
I'm pretty sure they're a Walmart.
Yeah, I think they sell alcohol at Walmart, and I know they sell guns, so.
So, Joel, is Python, like, in terms of, like, its rank, in terms of languages that are used to build machine learning systems like this, is Python the most popular, or just they, Unada happened to be using Python to do it?
Well, Unada at the time was using a bit of a mix and a hodgepodge. I came in kind of, they had two guys doing the initial prototype of it who have since gone on to do their own startup, and they were really just brought on to write up a prototype and kind of like get it out there so they could show investors. And the whole thing was meant to be stripped to the ground and rebuilt. They were initially using Rails as a front end for the HTTP API, since the whole thing runs off a mobile platform. And the back end was done in a mostly naive fashion on purpose to be able to be done quickly in Python. So when I came in, one of the first things I did was strip out the Ruby from the front end and replace it with Python, not for any religious reasons or whatnot, but really just because having one consistent language ends up being a little bit simpler to then hire for and to share skill sets across. So we didn't have to hire six people with Python experience and another four with Ruby experience and then not have them and then have a harder time moving people around from project to project, which is a big concern when you're a small startup.
But so I guess my question, sorry, go ahead.
So Python is actually very useful for prototyping and implementing a lot of machine learning algorithms because the ecosystem for all the tools is rather well kept, rather unique, I would venture to say. I think the only language that might come close, the only really commercially viable language that comes close would be Java in its library sets. C++ has some as well, but it's very, and then you end up having a program in C++, which is never really that much fun. Java has a very good set of libraries to do a lot of the similar things that Python can do. And other than that, I think the only real options you might have, academics will always be using MATLAB or some very similar tool. But Python just gives you a speed of development and access to huge amounts of libraries and SciPy, Scikit, NLTK, NetworkX, everything from graph algorithms to network flow analysis to your very base methods in machine learning that you need to have to be able to expand upon.
Interesting.
That sounds hard.
Well, of course it's hard, Ed. It's stuff that we don't know how to do, so of course it's hard.
Right.
Well, there's a lot of math involved. I think that's really just what gets a lot of people up, hung up on it, is that to understand what's going on, you need to be able to sit down and read a paper. Like, we'd go through papers on, we'd have an entire channel in our internal chat dedicated to interesting papers to read. And a lot of these were academic papers that were being published or had been published on various different topics. Maybe there was some new method for doing random walks on graphs that would yield some interesting results for product recommendation or tripartite graph recommendations. You might have had an interesting paper. Oh, a famous one that we looked at right from the get-go was the Netflix Prize paper. There's actually a lot of really good stuff in there, especially because they discuss all the things that worked and didn't work, which in academic papers, you never get to see the stuff that doesn't work.
So I got a question for you then. I got a question for you then, Joel. As a guy who's done both Python and PHP, what do you think is the what do you think is a common fallacy that PHP developers have about Python? Like, what do you think it is that PHP developers think that Python is that it isn't really? Like, what would you say to a PHP person about Python that they might not realize is true? You know what I mean? Like, there's bound to be, you know, every language has opinions about everybody who does development in one specific language always has ideas and potentially misconceptions about a particular language. So what would you say is the biggest misconception that from your experiences of both being in PHP and Python that PHP developers might have about Python?
You know, I don't hear a lot of, I'm pretty familiar with a big portion of the PHP community, and I really don't hear too many PHP devs ragging on Python very often. The PHP devs will rag about a lot of other languages, and I think it's kind of reciprocal. You hear the Ruby guys ragging on PHP a lot, some very well merited rags, but then PHP likes to fire back. Python devs just kind of do their own thing and try not to get involved in a lot of these holy wars, which I think is an admirable quality. I think my one, and this is someone who's done both languages rather extensively at this point, I think my one criticism, if I put my PHP shoes on, or maybe not criticism, but common fallacy, would be that PHP developers look at Python, they say that the language wasn't developed to work on the web. And they'd be right. Web capabilities for Python were added in progressively. It's now a very capable web language, and of course you have some very popular web frameworks in Python. Python also has as many web frameworks as there are Python developers, which is a common PHP joke. But it's no longer, the fallacy is exactly that. I think it's evolved quite a bit, and there's some very interesting things that you can do with Python. I think PHP devs sometimes get hung up on the on some of the syntax, the lack of curly braces, obviously because Python is white space limited, which can trip you up if you're not ready for it, for sure.
So when you were learning Python, were there any particular resources that you thought were helpful to you to make the switch? I mean, did you find it? I mean, I know from my own experiences with Python is that I haven't found it particularly hard to pick up the basics, but perhaps it's because I kind of approach it a bit of hodgepodge. I tried to do some Python, then I tried to do some Django, and in many ways, Django kind of reminds my early efforts with Django kind of remind me of my early efforts with Rails. How Django is kind of sort of a DSL sitting on top of Python. I mean, not as extreme. I don't think it's as extreme as it was, where Rails is really a DSL sitting on top of Ruby. But I just found I found it hard to try to learn Python and Django at the same time. I guess it'd be no different for someone trying to learn PHP and then a popular framework on top of PHP. So what are some of the things that you found helped you make a smoother transition based on your knowledge of PHP, trying to get up to speed and being not just familiar but productive with Python? Like, what are some of the things that you found helped you make that switch? Maybe making a switch is the wrong phrase, because you clearly haven't given up slumming with PHP, but just making it easier for you to get productive with Python.
So one of the first things I do whenever I'm trying to pick up a new language is obviously read up on the syntax and the standard libraries, because those end up being very useful. But don't try and get hung up on the fact that you're missing a whole bunch of, that you don't know that certain things exist or that a particular method might exist. Those usually come up on a per use case basis. You think, oh, well, wouldn't it be great if something did this? And usually some, you're not the first person who's thought of that. And if you're smart enough, you'll end up trying to search around and you'll find the little missing bit that you're looking for. But coming back, the thing I like to do the most is find a very popular and well-written library, something minimal, something that isn't hundreds of thousands of lines of code, and go in and just dive in and look at how it's structured. I think one of the hardest parts of picking up, not necessarily a language, but in a new way of thinking, an ecosystem, is looking how projects are structured. If you look at PHP, PHP developers tend to structure their projects in a certain way. They will put their classes in a certain folder. They'll put their Bootstrap files in this other place. Their files will have different conventions based on the projects that they're a part of. And much of the same thing exists for Python and for whatnot. So one of the first things I did is look at a fairly popular and well-regarded web framework called Flask. And looking through the code and the organization and the structure of how Flask was built was one of the more enlightening and more interesting experiences, and was probably instrumental in furthering my understanding of non-trivial Python code.
I have used Flask. I built a little Flask app that ran on Google App Engine just for a little toy website idea I had about lies that parents tell their kids. So it was just a little experiment on doing some Python web programming and fooling around with Google App Engine. So I have used Flask and I really like it. It's really a very minimal framework. Reminded me a lot of Sinatra from the Rails side in terms of its goal to be as kind of minimal as possible. And I guess some other things like Slim PHP and some of the other micro frameworks that Ed loves so much, it's kind of similar. In my
yep,
opinion,
it's
anyway.
Very similar. It's very similar in their goals to provide really just a thin glue layer that lets you do stuff quickly and gets the very big boilerplate out of the way. And Flask is written by a guy named Armin Ronecker, who's one of these stars of the Python community. He's written him and the team behind a team called Poco. I don't actually know how to pronounce that. Poco? 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 I've never said it out loud, funnily enough. They do a lot of really awesome stuff and have provided some libraries that fundamentally have changed how people develop in Python, especially for web applications. So,
Armin is one smart motherfucker, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You've probably used some of his code before. If you've ever used Pigments, the highlighting library, highlighting library.
Yep. That's used on my blog, yep. So it uses Pigments to do that.
So you use code that he's written or touched or blessed or whatnot. So
he blessed it for you.
Just for me and me alone. And I appreciate that.
You have to have an individual relationship with him.
It's like having a relationship with Jesus Christ, except with a Python programmer. It's almost the same thing as far as I'm concerned.
Is he your personal programmer?
No, you're my personal programmer.
That's right. Thanks, baby. That's nice. You did some stuff with some things
in that place that one time.
So you've been doing a lot of ops stuff lately, right? I mean, well, I know that because I work with you, and it seems like that you've been just doing ops stuff lately, and I hope that's okay because it seems to be what you're stuck doing.
Ed didn't add in the fuck you while you're at it too, but go ahead.
I usually tell to fuck off being the ops guy, so
right, exactly. Why do you tell this at work? But we've been doing some interesting stuff, I think, with VMs and stuff at Fictive, and I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that. I know Sean has talked about that a little bit, like in some He's given a couple. He's been at a couple.
Oh my god! I just want someone to show me how to use Vagrant properly. For God's sakes, that's all I want.
Well, there you go. See. So why don't you tell us a little bit about that? Since I don't know, I just type words in and it magically does shit, and I don't know how it works really.
It's good. That means I'm doing my job well.
Absolutely.
Since I've been working with Fictivekin, my role has been very much DevOps. DevOps, doing more ops than dev at this point, which is totally fine. I quite enjoy it as well. And I run it with Sean, and we've developed a very, very awesome infrastructure. I think it's probably one of the best remote development infrastructures that I have ever seen or heard of.
And so in what way is it tailored towards remote, though? I'm kind of intrigued by your statement.
Okay, so I can't talk about completely everything because there's some secret sauce in there, but I can give you the general overview. And Sean gave a talk about the basics of our setup, which is a good kind of like introduction gist to it, and that's already public information, so I'll be able to talk about that. Basically, we want to try and reduce the amount of friction to have developers help each other out, developers, ops, business people, whatnot. And you've kind of got different layers in which people do this, right? Everyone works in the same office, it's very easy. Everyone has their own development environment. You kind of just like make do and whatnot. Then the next level up is people might have a shared development server. So you log in and everyone is allocated like a vhost, or maybe you're using like FreeBSD jails or something of the sort. Getting a little bit more fancy, and everyone has a development environment that ends up being consistent. But then you have to be able to log in onto this machine. You might not be able to do it offline. Actually, probably won't be able to do it offline because it's a remote development server. You might have to be logged in. You might have to be at the office, or if you're not at the office, then you have to set up some complicated VPN client or whatnot. And doing all of this ends up costing you a lot of pain, costing you a lot of time and causing you a lot of pain. The next level after that is you want to have virtual environments that everyone can run. So you have some VM box that is pre-provisioned with all the different things that you need, web server, whatnot. And you say, okay, you know, check this out, do a shared folder thing with whatever code that we need to get on it, and then you're good to go. That's already miles ahead of the first step, but then you end up in situations where you need to update people's VMs. You maybe change the package of a library, or you need to upgrade a version of some essential component. And now you've got, you know, if it's 5 developers, it's not really too much of a problem, but if you've suddenly got 25 developers or 50 developers or whatnot, it becomes a huge pain in the ass. And this is where tools like Vagrant and a tool that we use quite heavily at Fictivekin called Puppet comes into play. So Vagrant is really just a really simple way of managing virtual environments in a headless manner. So you don't have to have them in a GUI or whatnot, and then click start and all this stuff. It really just gives you a command line interface to be able to start and stop virtual machines and configure them in a rather simple way. So we can assign like a host-only network. We can say, give it this much RAM, use only one of my 2 CPUs, and you know, share these 4 different folders and map them to these folders on the VM machine. And you can do this without having to go through like a point-and-click GUI, but you can do it instead by just editing your configuration file. And that's really awesome. The next step after that more people end up choosing, especially with Vagrant because it makes it so easy, is to have configuration management. Our tool of choice is Puppet. There also exists Chef, which is fairly popular, especially in the Ruby community. And another up-and-comer, which I'm paying close attention to, called Salt. All of these things, what they want to do is abstract away the configuration management of services. And a very simple introduction to that is if you've ever decided to put, let's say, your Apache vhost configurations under version control. You said, hey, I change these files a lot. Sometimes I screw up. It'd be great if I'd be able to roll back if I mess up. And you put them under like a small little Git repo. Or maybe you had them under SVN, you know, way back when that was still a thing. And that's a very introduction, very introductory step into configuration management, very naive and brittle way. Puppet lets you do these things in a much more formalized, much more centralized manner, in such a way that you declare resources and services and files and different types of resources and what they should look like when the whole system is configured. And that's basically what we end up doing for all of FictiveKin. So all of our production infrastructure, all of our staging, QA, all of our development VMs, 99% of every machine that we have running, and that last 1% is being fixed in the next day or so, is currently completely centrally managed and controlled. So that I can tell you what's running on any machine, on any development machine, on any production machine at any time.
I'm impressed.
I think from a developer standpoint, I think what is really nice about that is from the experiences that I've had trying to set up a development environment on the host, on like your host machine. So yeah, on OS X and, you know, on my MacBook or what have you. It seems like it's always been really hard to figure out like why it doesn't work on somebody's machine, you know, and there's so much more stuff that could go wrong, and you can't like directly manage, you know, say this remote guy's machine. And had cases where it was like, well, let's see if we can try to get it on the phone, or can you copy and paste, you know, what it's having. You're trying to, you know, it was a real nightmare to try to figure out, well, why is Apache keep screwing up for this dude or what have you. And it was particularly hard when you had people who needed to have a development environment weren't necessarily, say, folks who knew really in and out, like how to configure Apache or how to get these things up and running on their own.
Right. Which you shouldn't assume that someone knows how to do that. Right. Like if it's someone whose job is to do design or integration work, or maybe just QA.
Right.
And they might have those skills, but they shouldn't be required to use them because that's a waste of their time in a lot of cases, right?
Right.
And so I think with the system that we have, one of the great things is I almost never hear it doesn't work on my machine.
Right, exactly.
Because no one will ever say, oh, it works on mine and it doesn't work on yours. I don't know what the difference is, right? Because everything that we run is up to configuration values completely identical.
Yeah,
and we also have some of the secrets.
Yeah, this is something that I talk about too. And this is a nice segue as well, because both Joel and I will be speaking at Lone Star PHP at the end of June. And I'm doing a talk on, I know you're going to be doing your talk on machine learning for complete morons, and you're doing another talk, which escapes me because I'm not sitting in front of my computer, but I'm going to be talking about infrastructure debt, which covers some of this exact stuff that you've talked about, where you want to reduce, my whole thing is like, it's about reducing friction, but from a slightly different perspective, where my goal is to show people how to reduce that friction from when you get an idea of some code to implement it and how to get that up into production where everybody can see it with the minimum amount of hassles. Mm-hmm. And the use of VMs is something that I highly advocate. But like I talked about Twitter, and I've talked about this numerous times, where I must not be using Vagrant in the correct way, because I continually have problems with Vagrant deciding to not load the machine anymore or dropping my shared folders and stuff like that. So I'm about 99.999% convinced that I'm doing something in particular wrong.
It's a bit finicky. Like all virtual machine things, things tend to go wrong just as much as they go right. So VirtualBox is actually what powers Vagrant. VirtualBox is the actual VM system, and Vagrant is really just an API on top of that. And in reality, Vagrant actually talks to another API written by the same guy that is written in, and is also written in Ruby. So you're having an API that talks to a virtual machine. And things can go wrong very easily, especially when you're dealing with networking, if you're moving from place to place and changing IPs and all these things. So you're probably not doing anything wrong. It's just that the basic setup for Vagrant is not the most robust that for dealing with environmental changes.
You're so sweet for trying to tell me I'm probably not doing anything wrong. Meanwhile, I'm sure you're thinking that Hart is just a dumbass and he doesn't understand what he's doing.
No. I mean, there's many other reasons that you might be a dumbass, but this is
snap. No episode is complete with the guest insulting me, I'll tell you that much.
So, Vagrant is really optimized to get up and running really quickly. You download VirtualBox, you download Vagrant, you know, Gem install Vagrant, and you use one of the example Vagrant files, you download a bunch of stuff, basically a base image, and then boom, you're good to go. You have an instance running. There's a lot of other things that you need to think about or do to make it a more robust setup. And we do a lot of those things at FictiveKin because we've figured out what works and what doesn't. And it's not the same for every company or every set of individuals. I mean, there's a lot of things that we do that are very particular to the fact that we all live in different time zones around the world and very rarely see each other face to face compared to somebody who works in an office with 15 other people. They might not necessarily need all the little tweaks and refinements we've made to make sure that your computer can survive, you know, going to sleep and coming back up in a different network, and your VM just keep chugging along. And, you know, I can still SSH into Ed's VM and make changes, or I can, you know, go and check our production instances and make sure that everything is working correctly there. Certain companies might not need all that flexibility, and it might not be worth the time in the time and investment of energy to actually like, get there. So the nice thing is it's flexible. The bad thing is that it's flexible.
It kind of sounds like PHP. The good news is that it's flexible. The bad news is that it's flexible.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. I mean, there's like sets of best practices, but best practices are people have just started to really use virtual machines properly. And which is a funny thing because virtual machines have been around for so long. You look at, what was it called? What was that VM product that's really like the first one before Parallels? This was a long time ago. Like
I can't even remember, but I do remember early on when I was working for that very sketchy online cheat on your wife dating site that we used the concept of BSD jails to try to simulate kind of a virtual environment for the application. But I guess that's a kind of a really early example of, I don't know, not virtual machines, but more like isolated environments. So you could have multiple environments running on the same server.
BSD jails are actually the best of the breed. They're just a bit of a pain to get set up, and you have to be running BSD. And as a side note, that company still uses BSD jails, by the way.
No, I know. Yeah, despite my attempts to distance myself from them, I keep running into people that work for them. So, you know, what are you going to do?
Yeah. The BSD jails are actually, I think, the best possible implementation of this. The problem is that BSD isn't used by the general development community, at least in the ones that I work in. So there's a little lack of familiarity with the tool set and a little bit of resistance to adopting yet another difference in systems and architecture. They've existed for a long time, and people are really just starting to use them more for more interesting roles. I think a lot of it is because we suddenly have machines with a lot more memory. We have machines with a lot more CPU. We have a lot of different requirements than we did 10 years ago.
So let's segue into something else. Now, the first time I met Joel was at PHP Quebec, which is the precursor to Confu. And I remember sitting in – I was there when Joel suddenly learned how to use one of his most potent weapons was when Joel got an introduction to actual productive use of Vim when we were sitting in Andre, forgive me for butchering his last name, Zimievsky's presentation that he gave on using PHP with Vim. And so I wanted to get, because I've been a Vim user for about 4 years now, and I guess it must be almost about the same for you, I would think, at this point. And had you seen Vim Adventures? Did you check it out? It was being tweeted around, I guess, early today, late yesterday, where somebody's come up with a game where that's essentially Vim Tutor with a bit of a graphical interface. And if I read some other tweets correctly, you get up to a certain point and then you have to pay to continue playing the game. So what are your, so you want to talk a bit about your experiences with Vim? Because I know Ed's not a Vim guy and I've given up trying to convert him. So
you really never tried. You should try a lot harder.
Well, because you're, I'm not gonna call you names on the podcast. I'll save that for afterwards. But you know, just I want to talk a bit. If you want to talk a bit about Vim and your use of it specifically,
sure. I use it for pretty much everything. I have Vim open all day long, and it's my primary editor for almost everything I'll do. From anything from a to-do list to writing a patch for a project or implementing any of the things that I do for Victic, and it's always in some sort of Vimish environment. I love it. I've probably been using it for about, let me think now. Yeah, probably about 4 years, I guess. And it's become an essential tool set. I don't think I could go back to non-Vim world.
So what is it that you found about Vim that, I mean, I know everyone's experience with Vim is different, and for me it started off because I had to do a lot of code editing on remote servers, so it made sense to learn Vim. And then over time I found that I really liked the power of Vim, that you would have actually a quite powerful editor on its own out of the box, and then the fact that you could find plugins to do any number of redonkulous things. And so, and I especially found that as I started having to fool around with more languages, not just PHP, but Ruby, JavaScript, Python, all sorts of stuff, that Vim just seemed to be like, if you were dedicated to the path of the polyglot programmer, that it became harder and harder to ignore Vim, because Vim just gave you the ability of, you could throw almost any language at it, and Vim was like, bro, I can handle that no problem. Has that been your experience as well?
Yeah, I mean, the reasons I keep using it are numerous, but I think the main ones are, it's available everywhere. That's probably the number one. It's available everywhere. When I log into a remote machine, Vim is a very simple installation away if it's not already there. My configuration for Vim is rather minimal, and I'm very portable, so I can really just copy my config file and move it over to somewhere else, and I suddenly have my whole development environment that I'm used to and comfortable with available. Maybe minus some extra colors, because maybe the terminal doesn't support more than 256 colors.
Do you find yourself using a lot of plugins, or do you try to keep the set of plugins that you use to a minimum?
I try and keep the plugins to a set of minimal, to as minimal as possible. Of course, I add in a bunch of extra syntax files because the basic Vim install might not have syntax for newer things. For example, CoffeeScript. That's one that I have to install a syntax file for. Or
whoa, don't say that. You better hope that Sean fired. Doesn't hear this podcast. I was gonna say, you just got fired again.
I got to fire you by proxy.
Yeah. It's okay. I usually get hired again within the next 5 minutes, so mostly because there's too much stuff to do. So syntax files or whatnot, those end up being added rather liberally as they're needed. But yeah, the core Vim experience, I try and keep as minimal as possible. Because there's a lot you can do with just the basic motion commands that might scare off some people. I think a lot of people really just go with the very basic Vim editing modes, HJKL, and then some visual modes, and really don't explore objects, text objects, which ends up being the next most powerful element of it. So text objects combined with motion commands give you this whole world of possibilities. And then you add this with all the nice things that make Vim unique amongst all the editors, like the ability to set different jump points. Like I can set 26 different jump points in a file and between files. I can have 26 different named registers or copy paste buffers so that I can, you know, do a whole bunch of really fancy things with that and have a really minimal editor that doesn't get in my way along the way.
Like, I'm just looking here. I just took a look at my .vim directory just here on my MacBook, and I've got 19 plugins. So I'm wondering if I'm at the high end or the low end. I find the plugin that I really have gotten most used to that I probably couldn't do without is the Surround plugin, where I've gotten so used to highlighting blocks of text and then using Surround to do stuff to them, to wrap quotes around them, to wrap HTML tags. That's the thing I find the most when I try to use another editor that has Vim bindings, and I fool around with other ones once in a while, like Sublime Text 2 and other ones like that, just to get a feel for them. And I find that's always the thing that I've got, my muscle memory has gotten so used to highlighting blocks of text and then doing Surround stuff to them, that's the one feature that I really miss. I mean, I have other stuff here like NerdTree, which I've started using, Close Tag, Syntastic, Tabular to line things up, because at Kaplan Professional, we have a code sniffer that looks for coding standards to be followed, so I'm constantly having to line up array assignments and things like that. So Vim Fugitive, I have Puppet stuff in there, tag list, Vim Powerline, which gives me a really awesome looking status line. So, I mean, that's the thing that I like. And I find myself constantly kind of swapping plugins in and out depending on what I happen to be working with for an extended period of time. So that's the thing I find too, is I tell people, once you start using Vim, not only do you get the muscle memory wrecking you from using any other editor, because you end up with all sorts of colon W's and HJKL characters inside editor screens when you're using something that's not Vim. So that's always kind of humorous. I find myself forgetting that, oh, I'm not actually in Vim, so I can't just do a colon W and write a file to disk.
Don't you think
the
that
amount of times I've written an email and then hit colon W and be like, oh, wait, no, that doesn't do anything.
Don't you think
I used to be a mutt user as well. But. Oh,
I'm talking now.
Oh, sorry, Ed, go ahead.
Don't you think that muscle memory is like the thing that makes it, in the end, that's like what people fight over, and like that's what leads people to be so how should I say, loyal to a given editor, is really just that if you do something an exact, you know, a certain way 100,000 times, you know, it's really hard to disassociate that, like that action with that muscle movement.
I agree, yeah, because I think really, I mean, I'm a big believer in one of the tenets that the pragmatic programmer guys have, is like, pick an editor and learn that editor inside and out. It doesn't really matter which one that you're using. What matters is that you use that thing in the most efficient way possible and find out everything that that particular editor has to offer. So as the more time I invest in Vim and using things like Joel talks about, text objects and using plugins, and get it so that you're kind of doing things really automatically without thinking about them. Your brain just says, yeah, you need to do these keystrokes to accomplish a certain task. Then yeah, you almost, yeah, you're right to a certain extent, Ed, that you're fighting over muscle memory.
And I think that's one of the reasons why, like, I picked up Sublime Text pretty quickly, is because it's pretty similar to TextMate, and I was using TextMate for a few years. And then, but it's sort of like, but there were differences, and it took a little while to get around them. But now, like, once I use them, I know it's going to be a huge pain in the ass to get rid of it. Like, I'm going to want to hit, like, I'm going to want to highlight stuff and do Command D to, like, select all the other instances of that, of the characters in that selection in my file. And then I can just type over all of them at once, right? And I know that is going to be such an enormous pain in the ass if I ever want to switch to something else, because if it doesn't work exactly like that, I'm so used to doing that because I do that, you know, 50 times a day, that, you know, it really gets hard to switch to something else. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, I agree with that. Just find an editor that works for you. Everyone has different requirements, different projects, different ways of working. I used TextMate for a long time before I picked up Vim, and I realized that the thing I liked the most about TextMate was the configurability and the key bindings.
Right.
And that's what Vim has in spades. It really wasn't, you know, the very TextMate style things it had, you know, the command T find and all projects or files or whatnot. Those were nice, but I really enjoyed the ability to hit a key or two and then have a complex sequence of actions occur. And the idea of bundles as well, too. I think that an editor that is configurable to the point where you can extend it easily is essential, at least for me. And most modern editors and IDs fall into that category. So, I mean, if your preference is NetBeans or Eclipse as a fully integrated development environment, then, like, that's awesome. If someone's able to learn it and learn it well, more power to them. I quite enjoy Vim. And I'm not going to, you know, it's not a religious thing or a holy war that I'm trying to incite. It's really just, this is the editor that I've fallen in love with and I think is appropriate for nearly all the use cases that I put it through.
On the when I am on a Unix shell, I always use Nano because I used Pico when I ran Pine.
Yeah, Pico was my first editor too. Yeah,
right. So I still use Nano for all that junk, and I know.
Yeah, I used Pine in university.
Right, exactly. So, one of these days, I'm going to try to like write a blog post that tries to explain that Nano is actually like the way that people should be doing stuff. Like it, like Nano needs to be rediscovered, and
Nano
like,
is the superior editor.
Right, exactly. And like have a whole movement over it about it. Like I think it'd be
I'm gonna
double dog dare you to create Coco Nano. I want to see awesome. You do Coco Nano.
Get Coco Nano. Yeah, that'd be awesome. All the beauty of OS X with the power of Nano.
Sell in the App Store for $4.99 and then retire in the Bahamas.
Yeah, that would be great. I could ditch all ditch all you fuckers at work. Now, but what it is that I know how to get stuff done in Nano fast enough that like I just cannot bring myself to take the like 2 to 3 weeks it would take me to like get to up to speed in another less embarrassing editor, right? So I just can't.
Well,
I just can't
it takes
do
a
it.
While,
right? You know,
you're
because
right. Like doing that switch. I did it and I was working at Plank. So this was quite a while ago. And it was nearing Christmas. It was maybe early December. And that's usually a very like down time for a lot of projects. Nobody wants to start anything new because they don't want to start anything for the holidays. And I said, you know what? Now's a really good time. PHP Quebec, I had some, this was like a few months prior to that. I'd gotten some good exposure to it. And I said, I tried a little bit, but then kind of went back to TextMate because I need to be productive. I said, you know what, I'm going to hunker down and just do this. So I did a cold turkey. And for about a month and a half, maybe 2 months' time, my productivity was, I could feel that it was less than what it was when I was using TextMate. And I always had this urge to just open up the editor and say like, oh, well, I'll just edit this text in here because I know how to do it really quickly. But I resisted that. And instead, when I wanted to know how to do something quickly, I looked it up and how to do it in Vim. Which took 5-6 times as long, obviously, because I have to look up the commands and then I have to execute them and do it badly and redo it 2 or 3 times and finally get it right. But that was really instrumental to me being able to learn how to use the editor appropriately. And I think there are really 2 schools of thought. Some people say that you should just do it cold turkey, and others say, you know what, you can kind of ease yourself into it. But for me, the full cold turkey, I'm using Vim and nothing else, was really the shock to my system that it needed. I was totally unproductive. Well, not unproductive, but very, very much less productive than I usually was. Well,
that was a pretty abrupt end there. Yeah, it was the same thing with me. I started off slow and just worked my way around with the arrow keys and then learned how to highlight text and jump around from thing to thing, place to place. And I still feel, even after 4 years, there's tons I still need and want to know about Vim. And I don't think I'll ever stop finding interesting things. I think more likely is because my memory is so bad, I'll forget that I learned how to do something. And like 2 years later, I'll go back to it. I'm like, man, I wish I knew how to do this other thing. And then I'll discover it. And then I'll find fragments of it in my Vim, my VimRC file that, oh, at one time I did do some mappings to that particular plugin. What the fuck? I don't remember doing that at all.
Yeah. It's like every couple of months I have to reteach myself how to the syntax for awk, AWK.
Right.
So powerful, awesome. But like every time I teach myself, I'll use it for maybe a day or two to do some analysis of maybe like log files or whatnot. And then after that, I just completely forget everything I've learned. And then 3 months later, I have to do the same thing again. I have to relearn everything I just learned.
Yeah, if you don't, I'm the same way. If I don't do something consistently, I've had to, you know, you have to relearn over and over. It's really annoying. But a lot of times you just do a task and it's like, I mean, I've done that with a couple different things. Like I've written Python stuff here and there. Like I've used Python for like a couple web apps and stuff. But it was so spread out and it wasn't consistent. I never learned it well enough where I could have like jumped back in and just know what I was doing, you know? So it's always stuff like that. It's like, you know, how did I make this grep shit work? Or you know, Xargs. I always forget how to use Xargs correctly, right? And I always have to look it up. But because I don't need it for like 4 months or longer, you know? But then when I need it, that's like the only thing that's going to do this correctly. So, yeah, exactly. I just have to look it up, you know, or Google it or something like that, you know, to figure out how to redo how to, you know, do this task. So, yeah.
So, Ed, do we want to pester Joel about his time as a core developer for not just one, but two pretty well-known PHP web application frameworks, or do we want to save that for a future appearance?
Oh, I think it'd be interesting if he's up for it.
You up to talk about your cake and lithium time, Joel?
Sure.
I think I'd be interested in, you know, well, obviously, you know, I've written some about sort of some of my thoughts about, I guess the use of full stack frameworks versus, you know, small frameworks, micro frameworks, and. Are you laughing at me? I can hear you laughing at me, Chris.
Dude, that ship sailed a long time ago. let me put it this way, Ed. I respect your position. I may disagree, but I respect it.
Right. So, So, you know, I obviously talked a fair bit about that, and that, you know, my preference is strongly for having, the smallest code base possible, I guess you'd say. But still comprehensible, and you know, lots of small, or maybe not lots, but small components that fit together and are easy, really easy to understand. So that's why I like, you know, micro frameworks like Flask or Sinatra or things like that. So I'm more like that guy as opposed to like Django or Zen Framework or Symfony, you know, or stuff like that. Now, I've done a little bit of stuff with Lithium, and I never mess with Cake. So I don't know. Mm-hmm. I'm not in a good position to make any kind of judgments about those or speak intelligently on it. But, you know, so within that context, I'd be interested to hear kind of what your thinking is, like, now, you know, having been somebody who worked at Core on a couple of popular I guess you'd say full stack frameworks.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I was lucky enough to have the privilege to work on the Cake PHP core team for, almost 2 years. And as well work on the core team and still work officially on the core team for Lithium. Although I don't contribute much these days, mostly because of lack of time. I have read your blog posts on micro versus, I guess, macro frameworks, and I myself give talks on this particular topic once in a while as well, too. And I think you do bring up a lot of good points, and for a large part, I think you're right. And I know this might sound weird coming from someone.
All right, that's all the time we have for Joel today.
This might sound odd from someone obviously who has invested a lot of time and effort into two popular full-stack frameworks. But I think you'd find that the harshest critics of full-stack frameworks tend to be the people who develop them.
Right.
And when I was working on Cape, we were very well aware of all of the problems that the framework had, because we were also some of the heaviest users of it. Mm-hmm. Same thing with Lithium. I mean, it's a new framework, but the people who develop it are oftentimes ones who will really push it to its limits and will find all those weird corner edge cases. Now, of course, this isn't, you know, a hard, fast rule, but that's been my experience. And the general thing I like to tell people is that a full stack framework is very useful when you don't know where you're going to be going. If you're, for example, when I worked at Plank, they are a web development agency that have many different clients. And their mandate is to create something that's visually and aesthetically pleasing, something that is very usable and can be, and a project that can be done within time and within budget. And repeat this, you know, a dozen times a year. For something like this, where you don't always know where the scope of the project is going to be for the next client, or even during the same client, since things tend to change so often, a full stack framework is a fairly good choice because it affords you a lot of flexibility. And it gives you a large resource base because there's a healthy community around it, there's a lot of people doing work on it, and you can get bootstrapped into a new project rather quickly. For something like a startup, a full stack framework is probably not the best choice because, yes, you might be able to get started very quickly, but the thing you're trying to avoid the most, which will happen anyways, is technical debt, because that just accrues over time and suddenly starts hindering your actual development. Whereas for something like a web agency, that's really not an issue because a project is done and completed within a couple months' time and is very rarely visited upon for anything more than minor updates or changes thereafter.
Right.
Whereas for a startup or someone who is building an actual product, the goals are very different. So something like a micro framework that lets you get started very quickly but doesn't invoke a lot of dependencies is, I think, a better choice in general for that group. If you're just getting started into web development and programming, I also discourage full stack frameworks in general because they hide a lot of complexities that you should be aware of. The fact that people are using frameworks like Cake and don't actually know what cross-site request forgeries are or XSS, the fact that some developers are using these frameworks but don't know what these terms mean is a bit scary and a bit frightening.
So I guess there's a couple, it's interesting you say that, because one response I've gotten to some of the stuff that I've talked about has been that full-stack frameworks are better for beginners or because not everybody can be an expert, really high-level programmer, and that it allows developers who maybe are not highly skilled, it allows them to do things more safely and follow best practices, whereas you have more flexibility with I guess the idea being the full stack framework basically sort of puts you on a certain path, or let's say rails that you go on that keeps you going in the same direction.
Well, I think, again, it depends on what you want to do,
right?
Where it's the same issue as I was discussing before.
Right.
Are you trying to get better at programming, at web application programming? In that case, you want to actually know more about HTTP. You want to understand how cookies fundamentally work. You want to understand how and what a session is and how it can influence and how your application can use it. Whereas if your objective is to just crank something out very quickly, which is a totally fine thing as well. Like I'm not looking down upon that at all. If your job is to just get something out and quick and just be usable, then a full stack framework is a better choice in that regard. So it really depends on the short and long-term goals of what you're trying to achieve.
Yeah, I can dig
that. So some people are right. A full stack framework is easier to learn on. You can make less mistakes. Well, if the point is to make mistakes so that you can learn from them, then the full stack framework will hide that from you for a much longer time than something more stripped down, right? And if you're trying to be a better developer, you shouldn't go for a long period of time without understanding how basic HTTP requests work and understanding the difference between a GET request and a POST request and a PUT and a DELETE and all these things. Because the application layer will just hide that from you. Like, that should not happen.
Right.
If it does happen, it's because you've implemented it and you've understood it and... or you've added a separate library to your micro framework because you made that implicit choice. Explicit choice that you needed this particular library to do these particular tasks. And that implies a lot more thought that went into the process.
So, Joel, do you think that the trend now where it looks like Symfony 2 and Xen Framework 2 seem to be trying to... I'm trying to think of the right label to make themselves an enterprise micro framework. Is that a fair label to apply where they're trying to keep a small core and then you build up your application by applying components on top of it? Do you think that will go a long way towards your idea that, I'm kind of torn because a lot of times I agree that for beginners, it actually may be quicker for them to build an application with a full stack framework, just like you talked about. But again, they end up understanding how to build something with the framework and not necessarily with PHP. So do you think that maybe this tendency where both the major PHP frameworks are trying to go with a small core and then bring in components to accomplish tasks, do you think that will kind of help people who want to build stuff with PHP kind of get the best of both worlds?
I don't know. That's a good question. I can let you in on a dirty little secret. The reason this happens with frameworks is because the core developers want to maintain less code. So by giving people hooks and a whole plugin architecture and system and the ability to override as many little or large pieces of the framework as possible, you let the community start to manage things instead of you having to manage everything. Because a line of code that a core developer needs to maintain is very rarely one line of code. It's usually four or five lines to add some very trivial little feature, plus another 50 lines of tests, the unit tests and integration tests and functional tests. And then the other like page and a half of documentation that describes how this feature works and how it integrates with all the other systems and whatnot. So everything you can avoid maintaining in the core is a win. And I think this is generally why everyone does it, whether or not Symfony or Xen have particular reasons, whether it be financial or market oriented or not, I don't know. But the plugin / component based architecture is fundamentally one that's easier to maintain over the long run, because you end up in a lot less technical debt, again, to use that word, which I don't like, but is very descriptive.
Well, you don't like, what do you think it should be called instead then if it's not technical debt? What do you think's a better label? Dumbass decisions?
No, because sometimes you take on, actually every project will take on technical debt that they know is technical debt, right? You do it because you know there's some faster way of doing it. It's the reason why, you know, you look at someone, you say, well, why didn't you write just, you know, a two-line bash script to do that? And you're like, well, no, that's not extensible. And they write some huge object-oriented system to do what a two-line bash script was able to do. And I think technical debt has this negative connotation to it, but sometimes it's really just the right choice at the right time. And it continues to be that right choice for a long period of time until circumstances arise that make it so it needs to be refactored or changed, or it suddenly affects other parts of the systems in a negative fashion. So I just dislike the negative connotation that technical debt has, when a lot of times you knowingly take technical debt and you are okay with it. And sometimes it's the right choice.
Well, so an example I brought up, I did this micro PHP talk at OinkPug, the Ohio, Indiana, Northern Kentucky PHP users group down in Cincinnati just last week. And, you know, one of the things, I think a good example of a choice that, like, we made effective can in a lot of places do is that we use Elasticsearch and for search stuff because it does search really, really well. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I don't think any of us are like would have just decided, let's put, you know, the Java runtime on there and install Elasticsearch and all that stuff, unless there was a really, really big win you get out of it, right? Mm-hmm. Because that's a bunch of other shit we have to worry about, right? To make sure that that thing's operating correctly. It's, you know, none of our other systems rely on, like, the Java VM and things like that. So we, but you get that big win out of that product, and sometimes it makes sense. Maybe it's not always debt, but I guess maybe you might say technical responsibility, technical baggage, maybe. I don't know.
There's got to be a better. There's got to be a better label. I mean, technical debt is the easy one, and I agree with Joel. It has a bit of a negative connotation to it. But I mean, I've been while we've been talking about this, I've been trying to think of a better descriptive label to a better label for it. And I don't know. I can't think of. I just can't think of a better one. I don't know. There must be one. I just don't know what it is.
Well, it's convenient because, you know, everybody kind of knows what you're talking about when you say that. So
I guess it's just – I guess it's an unfortunate label. It's like a brand name to describe a certain set of policies that and decisions that people make when they're building apps. And, you know, there is technical debt and there's other types of debt. There's that to be the egomaniac and plug myself again. There's infrastructure debt, which is a concept that's sort of orthogonal to it, but it's the idea that it's debt and just like in real life, there's good debt and there's manageable debt and there's I'm going to be sleeping in my car type of debt. So,
Yeah, I don't have a better suggestion for a word. If I did, I would have mentioned it by now.
Hey, what's it in French? Maybe we should use the French one because it'll sound cooler.
Oh, God. I don't know any technical terms in French.
Le debt technical?
Well, in French...
Le debt polytechnique? Is there a better one? I don't know.
In French, don't the French insist on making up their own words for all, like, technical terms?
It depends. In
I've Quebec, heard that, like, officially, I guess in France is what I'm thinking of. I don't know about Quebec.
Quebec is actually more strict on that than in France. France, they have a body called l'Académie Française, which is organized with figuring out new words for new things.
Joel talks French. That's awesome. Keep going, bro. Mm-hmm.
So let's say you come up, there's a new thing that's invented, you know, like a computer, right? Computer comes out. Nobody's ever heard of a computer before. We need some word to describe it. L'Académie Française is the organization that's tasked with figuring out a new word to describe this thing. The problem is that they take a long time to do it. And by the time they come out with a new word and publish it in the dictionaries and make it official, people have already adapted either an existing word in French or have hijacked a word from another language, most of the time English.
So basically, they're like the linguistic equivalent of the W3C.
Yeah, basically. Everyone's already passed on. They're like, dude, we figured that out.
Right.
4 generations ago. And so you end up with words that in France that we don't use in Quebec or in Canadian French because we've already our usage of the word is much more current and we figured out a word for it far ahead of time. I think my favorite one is email. In France, they'll just say email with a French accent. And
Email.
Nice. Yes, email, baguette, and then in Quebec, the very common term that you'll see on billboards that people use very on an everyday basis is courriel. And that's just how it is. You say courriel to someone from France and they have no idea what the fuck you're talking about. What? Yet it's the more official word than email, which is really just the, you know, the stolen word from English.
I thought that was like a pastry. So that wasn't?
Only on this podcast do we let our ignorance shine through like a badge of honor.
Oh, no. My whole life, really. Not just here. I do this all the time. I think everybody knows.
As listeners of the podcast know very well.
Yeah. Exactly. Or anyone who's ever met me. What were we talking about? I totally forgot.
We were talking about technical debt, and we were trying to. And I said I want to know what it's called in French.
Mm-hmm. Technical sandwich.
And I think I just killed the podcast with that commentary. Yeah. God damn it!
I'm afraid to open up my browser and look at our notes. Do we have anything else to talk about?
know, let's see, we covered Vim Adventures. Well, we kind of talked about it, but Ed was like, fuck Vim, I don't use it, so he didn't want to talk about it. We talked about machine learning for noobs, sort of. We talked about Python from a PHP perspective, sort of. Ed hijacked the podcast for me to talk about DevOps with Joel.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know, man. We don't have much else to talk about. You want to make fun of Engine Yard for a little bit, and then we can end it, Ed?
Yeah, I kind of feel like I should bring up their website to do that properly.
So oh, here we go.
I hope this
has become my favorite part of the podcast, Joel, where Ed makes fun of the sponsor.
All right. I hope this won't kernel panic.
Seems like a prudent course of action.
Yeah, exactly. I actually, you know, went down to Cincinnati. And,
oh, wait, graphing. We want to talk about graphing in JavaScript because you've been working with
that. Yeah, I guess we'll talk about that for a second. We should probably have a little Engine Yard break. So let me bring up their website and see if there's something I can find that's embarrassing here.
Other than their continued association with Elizabeth Naramore?
That is embarrassing. I stayed at her place in Cincinnati, and
really?
Not like that. But
damn.
Yeah, and anyway,
the episode itself. But keep going.
And I met her, and you know the dude Rubius.
Yes, I know Scott.
Scott's a great guy, and I got to hang out with him. We watched.
Despite him being a sleazy Ruby guy, he's all right.
He is very sleazy. Just beside the Ruby thing. And we watched Hot Tub Time Machine. Neither of them had seen that movie. And so, have you seen Hot Tub Time Machine, Chris?
I have not.
But I know you don't have anything better to do. So
the fuck does that mean?
I know where you're stuck in La Crosse or whatever. That there's nothing to do there.
Hot Tub Time Machine is a great bad movie.
Yeah, you should watch that. It's on Netflix, so...
In fact, after this is over, I have to update the PDF version of my blog of my book for Lulu.com, so don't be judging me on whether I'm doing nothing.
Dude, nobody's going to buy that.
Ho! What do you mean nobody's going to buy it? That's not nice.
That was subtle, Chris. Subtle plug.
See, Joel's the only guy that got it. That's awesome.
That was for... Yeah, see, I was just looking for another chance to...
to enrich your fellow podcaster. I understand how it is, Ed.
So Engine Yard, I think, sponsors the... I think they did... They sponsored... Did they sponsor the Vagrant development? Like, development of Vagrant?
I don't know. I can see, it tends to be one guy that's maintaining it. Obviously with contributions from a lot of other people. But I don't actually know where he works.
I'm trying to bring it up now, and... Probably this isn't the best thing because the Engine Yard website is suddenly really slow. But
maybe they're spinning up new instances.
Yeah, that must be what happened. Let's see what stupid stuff they've got listed here under their open source. Whatever. Ruby on Rails. Who cares about that? Fog. I don't care about that. I was really sure they had done something with... Watch it be like some other competitor of theirs.
Like Heroku or something?
Yeah, something like that would be awesome. let me see. Vagrant. That would be great if it was.
Oh, well, I see a blog post on Engine Yard. I just did a search with the Googles, and it tells me that.
Maybe that's it. It was on their blog, so I kind of thought they must have something official.
Back in December of 2010, they talked about how they've been directing some of their clients, and they're teaching some class. It seems like they were talking about they had some people in at before Thanksgiving in 2010, and they had their training team, Engine Yard University, and they wanted to show people some stuff about virtualization, and they recommended people use Vagrant. So they just showed how they talked about how they kind of did a class, and they showed people how to use Vagrant to. Using Vagrant, we built a headless VM that runs a full Ruby on Rails stack for local development.
Well, on the 30th of March, this guy Mitchell Hashimoto,
right?
And it says Engine Yard gave him a grant to work on it a couple of years ago. So, and and I think he posted this because he had just like 1.0 came out just like a few weeks ago. So
nice. So Engine Yard doing its part for the community by throwing some money at Vagrant dude.
Right.
Wonder if he looks like a Vagrant.
Well, have you seen the icon for it?
Yeah, but this is, I mean, like that's a hobo. That's a hipster looking guy. Who knows if he really looks like that?
Yeah, that guy looks like he rides a like a fixie in Portland. It looks like he's about to take his pants off at the Portland airport while he's going through security.
Oh, God. I can't get that image in my mind now.
What does that mean? Oh, was that that guy? Oh, that's right. A guy took all his clothes off and walked naked through security, right?
Yeah, that was in Portland.
As some sort of totally misplaced protest against the system, man.
Yeah.
I'd still make him give me a pat down. Like, no, you got to be sure.
Yeah, right. Yeah, right.
Dude, as a foreign national in another country, I'm like frightened to death to upset those people because I may never be allowed to come back here again, which may please a lot of people, but it would put a serious dent in my career, I think.
Does that mean, can your wife declare you legally dead if that happens?
I'll have to ask her.
Yeah. I don't know.
I'll have to talk to my lawyer and my accountant and see if, can we have me declared legally dead as a way to get around these restriction rules of entering into the United States?
Right. Well, it's not a person, so.
Maybe for tax purposes, I can be dead for 4 years. We'll have to figure it out.
Yeah, why not? It's good. Well, the kid, he's got his little picture here next to his blog post, and he looks like a clean-cut kid. So, I don't know. Anyway, yeah, it looks
like. I hate
like,
when those guys, we can't make fun of them, because, you know, that makes them seem more human, and that's just not cool.
Well, he did say this. People like Yehuda Katz and John Rezig were my idols. I'm just taking that as a quote out of there. So take from that as you will. I don't know.
John Rezig is awesome. John Rezig makes everyone else look unproductive.
Except he couldn't finish his fucking Secrets of the JavaScript Ninjas book.
Well, that's okay because the cover was a samurai. So it was a big lie anyways.
That would have upset me.
What's that book been in development? 12 fucking years now? I still get emails that it might be done someday soon.
I don't know.
I find it shocking that Guns N' Roses got Chinese Democracy done before John Rezig got his fucking JavaScript Ninjas book done.
That Duke Nukem Forever was released before JavaScript Secrets of the JavaScript
that's
Ninjas?
That's even more embarrassing. That's
you know that Rezig isn't even author on it anymore. He wisely said, I obviously can't finish this, and now they've got some other people or something.
But why did you wait 6 fucking years to do it? That's my...
I guess the thing that bugs me is that, and I guess I understand why they don't want to, but it seems to me that maybe they should just give everybody's money back. You know? Because...
It's like us with Engine Yard. We're not giving that money back for any goddamn reason.
They have surely made plenty of money off the interest.
I think rule number one of corporate business is if when you get their money, don't give it back to them.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's it. And did you order that book too, Joel? Because
I didn't.
Well, when I said something about it, like on Twitter a few days ago, it's like 6 or 7 people were like, "Yeah, I ordered that book too." And it's, I think a lot of people paid for that book, and it's been like 4 years.
At least.
That's depressing.
I know I can download early access stuff, but just give me, I paid for the book.
One of these things now, like when you have to talk to John Rezig, his publicist says, and you're not allowed to talk about Secrets of the the JavaScript Ninja book?
He'll get really mad, and
you can talk about anything. You can talk about jQuery. You can talk about his work for Khan Academy, all that other shit. But no, you're not allowed to talk about that book that he never fucking finished.
Yeah. I think if you say it 3 times fast, he has to appear in your living room.
Yeah, he's like Candyman. Shit, that's awesome.
I'm so dared. John Rezig. Oh, God. Oh, no, he's not here.
Don't say that.
It's because we're in a different time zone. That's the problem.
Right, yeah. So, you know, the graphing stuff, I'll just talk about next time. That's fine. But
we can talk about it when it's just you and me, and we don't have anyone else to talk to.
I might also know a little bit more about it. I've only been screwing around with it 2 days, basically, and I really barely know what I'm doing. So,
yeah. All right. So, Joel, thanks so much for coming on, dude. This has been a good talk, and as always, despite my jokey demeanor, I've learned a lot from talking to you today.
It's been tons of fun.
Yeah, it's been great talking to you guys too.
So, as always. Thank you very much to Engine Yard for sponsoring our podcast. This is what, number 4 of 5 or 3 of 5? I can't remember how many we agreed to do for them. Is it 3 now, Ed?
Well, I know what we agreed.
Because I don't know because you still haven't sent me my share of the money. Hint, hint.
That's really what it's about. you're not supposed to talk about that on the podcast, dude. God.
Stars and Coke aren't free, Ed.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think this might be the fourth one under the sponsorship thing.
One more. So if anyone else is listening and want to throw some money at us so we can talk shit about them, I am totally open to that.
Yeah, if like Joyant would like to sponsor us. Or well, I probably shouldn't mention other competitors. But
maybe Fictive Kin would like to sponsor the podcast.
Dude.
You think we have money? Yeah. They pay me in candy corn.
Yeah, and actually,
in Canada, candy corn can be used as currency.
You
so.
Can trade that for raccoon.
Use that now that we eliminated the penny. You'll be able to pay for stuff in single denomination candy corn.
Right. That's what'll replace it. That or bottle caps.
All right, so I think we've come to the end because we're getting all punchy. So this has been Development Hell Podcast, episode number 11. As always, thank you so much for sticking around to the bitter end to hear me make fun of Canada's currency about being replaced with candy corn. So we also want to spank
our friends at Engineer.
Thank our very special guest, Joel from Krypton, for agreeing to fly in and share his otherworldly powers with us this week. So as always, you can find us online at devhell.info. You can find us on Twitter at dev_hell. You can find me on Twitter as Grumpy Programmer without the U. You can find Ed as Funkatron with the U. Thanks so much for listening. This has been Development Hell Podcast number 11. We'll see all you guys soon.
Yeah, and make sure to rate us on iTunes so we can get rich.
All right. Peace out.